Everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. Here it is, December 24th, Christmas Eve day, and I'm looking outside at a gray 70-degree day outside. What is wrong with that? Well, it doesn't feel quite like Christmas, but anyway, it is a beautiful Thursday, and the season is upon us, and everyone's spirits are high. This week, Tuesday, was my 21st annual Feeding the Homeless at Rufus King Park in Jamaica, Queens. And it was a great day, even though it was rainy and wet, as this whole week has been. We still had over 600 people waiting out there with umbrellas online to get a plate of baked ziti, Caesar salad, garlic bread, brownies, apple pie, along with loads of toys and gifts that were collected. We had two Santas on board. One was sitting with the children giving out presents, and the other one was walking down the line handing out hot cider and hot coffee to everybody waiting on line in the rain. So it was really great. It's always a wonderful, wonderful feeling to be there. Unfortunately, I see so many of the same people year after year coming out. And, you know, I partner with the organization called the River Fund Food Pantry. And, you know, to break the cycles of hunger and cycles of poverty is really more than just obviously giving people a plate of food. And I have to say that the River Fund New York is really, really trying to do that. They befriend each of the families that come to the pantry. They get to know them. They get to know their kids. They started a financial aid program for education, for colleges. They have like a dozen kids that they're helping sponsor through school. And they, you know, are really, really changing the outlook of many of these families by helping to educate their kids and get them on a road to success. So applauds to the River Fund Food Pantry. Thank you to all my volunteers and donors who helped make this possible. It's really just an amazing thing. And so it's wonderful. Anyway, so now we're getting ready for our own Christmas here. But I have a great show planned for you today, and I want to share that with you. My guest today will be Eric Weltman from Food and Water Watch. He's a senior organizer there. And he's going to talk to us about how the Paris Climate Talks that just wrapped up this month, how they were different than the 2009 Copenhagen talks, which were not quite as successful. And we're going to talk a little bit about the climate talks and about next steps and what we can do to keep that momentum going to try to get the United States on board to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and to be on a path to using renewable energies and reducing our global footprint. So that's what we need to do. I have some petitions on my website that I'd like to tell you about and like to encourage you to sign on board. The first one is a petition to ban fracking on public lands. Right now, we have over 34 million acres out there being leased for to the oil and gas companies, and our public land is really one of the pride and joys of our country, and we just can't let that go to waste. And literally, that is what happens to the land once these gas and oil companies get their hands on it. So please sign that petition. There's also a petition about signing on board to asking the debate moderators for the for rising sea levels, you know, asking presidential candidates questions about the rising sea levels. Right now, you know, we have all these debates going on, and they're not asking enough questions about global warming, what they're going to do when the waters rise, how are they going to handle these issues that are going to come up, that have been coming up, and here's a debate, you know, here's a petition to try to get moderators to ask some of the more important questions. And then the last one that I have on is about Monsanto's dark act. I'm sure you heard, as I reported in the past, that we did stop that bill in the Senate. It had passed in the House, but we stopped it in the Senate. That was the legislation that would have allowed it to become illegal for states to have their own mandatory labeling laws. And we stopped that, but we have to keep the pressure up. And so there's a petition there to let our congressmen know that we take this issue very, very seriously, and we want labeling. We have a right to know what's in our food. We want transparency. And that's just not the direction it's going, even though most citizens want that. For instance, one of the things I have on my newsletter in the news is about the country of origin labeling. We fought for years to get meat labeled so that we would know where it was coming from, so people could make a choice to buy the meat locally or not locally. Of course, it didn't really say whether it was sustainably raised or not, although we know we just need to buy organic meat or know the farmer where you're getting it from if you want to make sure that the meat that you're eating is raised without hormones and antibiotics. But that set aside, this is just the right to know where it's coming from. Do you want meat that is produced in Mexico or one that's produced in the United States? We don't know about the inspections and, you know, what kind of infrastructure is going on in other countries, although we know it's pretty bad in this country. So the truth is, if you buy industrial meat, it almost doesn't matter. However, we do have a right to know, and this country of origin labeling that we had fought so hard to get has now been repealed. And so, you know, I just want you to stay tuned about that. I want you to know about it. So if and when we can do something, we will let you know. But right now, you know, the whole consumption of meat is an issue that we're going to be talking about later on in the show, because people don't like to talk about all the greenhouse gas emissions that come from the production of meat, but it's something that we really all need to start talking about, looking at, and making compromises with so that we can help reduce that. Also in the news came out this week a study how 12 minutes of yoga is better for your bone health than any of the drugs that you can take out there for osteoporosis and as such. You know, all the drugs that you take do have side effects, and yoga only, the only side effect of yoga is a better range of motion, higher strength, reduced levels of anxiety, and a better gait. So we recommend doing a little bit of yoga daily or even every other day, and that's really going to be really great for your health. And, you know, we all want to try to get off some of these drugs and be a more proactive health society. It's just too easy to just think you can take a pill and do it that way. Lots of great events coming up, although not as many as we have some other times of the year. You know, during the holiday time, it kind of peters out a little bit. Everybody's involved in their own holiday parties. But I did want you to know that on December 30th, the documentary film is going to have a showing called In Defense of Food. It's Michael Pollan's documentary screening, free on PBS across the country. Check your local times to find out when it will be airing. In New York, it's at 9 o'clock on December 30th, Wednesday, December 30th. But it will be December 30th across the country, so check your times. I'm sure it's going to be good. He's the man who brought us the documentary Food Inc., and this one I'm sure is going to be just as good. January 18th through February 5th is New York City Restaurant Week. That's always a fun opportunity to try out some restaurants that otherwise might be out of your reach. So check those out. January 22nd through the 24th is NOFA, New York's Winter Conference. That's the Northeast Organic Farming Association. It takes place at the Saratoga Springs Hilton every year, and it is a great conference. It's you know, in the summer conference, very often we don't get as many of the farmers as you'd like to meet. In the winter conference, all the farmers come out, and it's a really wonderful time to meet with farmers and producers and consumers, and everybody comes together, and it's a lot of fun and very informative. So the schedule you can see up online. You don't have to go for the whole weekend. You can just go for a day or for a half a day, you know, and focus in on the conference that really interests you. So check that out online. February 3rd, Slow Food is promoting a Slow Wine World Tour, and they're going to be hitting lots of cities in their tour. And, of course, they will be coming to New York, and that will be February 2nd and 3rd in New York. As soon as I know what wine store they will be at and what will be going on, I will let you know. So stay tuned for that. But the Slow Wine Guide you can take a look at online. You know, but it talks about good, clean, and fair food. And that's one thing a lot of people don't think about when they're drinking wine, is that wine is also important to try to get organic or sustainably raised. Because grapes, as you know, are on the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen list, and they're very heavily sprayed. And when you're getting a concentrated wine, or, you know, wine made from the concentration of the grapes and the grape skins, you're getting all that pesticide in that wine, not to mention the added sulfites that they put in to prevent mold. So Slow Wine Tour will be really great. It's good, clean, and fair wine raised in a sustainable way. February 8th through 9th is the Bionutrient Food Association Soil and Nutrition Conference. That's going to be taking place up at the Kripalu Center in Stockbridge, so you can do a little yoga while you're studying your soil and nutrition. So that should be a great conference. That's February 8th through 9th, and you can find out more information on the Bionutrient Food Association's website. That's bionutrient.org. February 13th, the Long Island Regional Seed Consortium is having a seed swap, and that's a great time to bring your seeds and swap for some other seeds that you want. And it's great because it's local to Long Island. And as we all know who are growing food, when you get seeds that are from our regional area, they're really adapted to this area and they do better. So, and it's also a nice opportunity to meet some other farmers and backyard gardeners. So, that is going to be, I'm actually not sure where that's taking place. It's to be decided. As soon as I hear, I will let you know, but it is a free event, and it's on February 13th, so save the date for that. February 16th through 18th, this is out of town, but I thought some of you might be interested. It's the Local Seafood Summit taking place in Norfolk, Virginia, and Local Catch is the organizer of this event. And it's going to bring lots of community leaders and representatives from the fishing sector together to collaborate and connect and create and to network to support local fishing, ecological fishing, and economic sustainability in fishing. And so it's all really important stuff. So if you're interested in that, check that out. And then there's also a Slow Fish in New Orleans, March 10th through 13th. Great opportunity to go visit New Orleans. I'm going to see if I can get there. I've never been to New Orleans, believe it or not, and this is a good opportunity to go. And save the date, March 13th, for the Just Food Conference. This is always a wonderful, wonderful coming together of lots of local community leaders, CSA members, food advocates, rural farmers, and urban farmers. So just a great day. It's up at the Teachers College at Columbia University all day long on March 13th. Variety of different prices for students and others. So check that out on the Just Food Conference website. And there's more. Just check out my website at ieatgreen.com for more events, because there's so many, but I don't want to take more time because I still want to share my recipe with you and invite Eric Weltman on. So the recipe I'm going to share with you today is a gluten-free vegetable cheese lasagna. This time of year when you have lots of people coming together, you know, there's nothing like a simple meal of lasagna, salad, garlic bread, you know, just really comfort food and really easy to make ahead of time so you don't have to do the work when your company's there. So this is a gluten-free only because I'm using gluten-free rice noodles. But you can use, you know, if you want to use regular noodles, you certainly can. Whole wheat noodles, whatever you like. So first I'm going to go through the ingredients and then the directions. So you can make the tomato sauce. For that you need olive oil, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 onion chopped, 6 garlic cloves minced, 2 cups of canned tomatoes, you can use diced or whole, 1 jar, 32 ounces of organic tomato sauce, 1 half cup of organic dry white wine, 1 half cup of fresh basil, or 2 tablespoons of dry basil if you can't get fresh, 1 bell pepper. I actually like to use the orange or yellow peppers because they look really pretty in the tomato sauce. But if you can only find green, do that. Peppers are one of those vegetables you want to try to get organic. They are on the Dirty Dozen list, so if you can get organic, that's better. 8 ounces of mushrooms, sliced. You can use either just white mushrooms. You can also use cremini mushrooms if you'd like. 1 bay leaf and 1/4 cup fresh chopped parsley, and that's Italian parsley that you want, not the curly. For the filling, you need 1 cup of half and half organic, 2-pound jar of ricotta cheese, 1 pound of shredded mozzarella, 2 eggs, 1/4 cup of Romano and Parmesan mix, or either or, whichever you like, 1 5-ounce box of baby arugula, and 1 box of rice lasagna noodles. That's a 1-pound box. Okay, so if very often they cut the boxes down now. So you want 1 pound of rice noodles. So for the sauce, you're going to saute the onion, garlic, and pepper in the olive oil until they're soft. Then you're going to add the mushrooms. Once those get cooked down, you're going to add the white wine and cook it and let the wine reduce a bit before you add the canned tomatoes, the tomato sauce, the basil, and the bay leaf. And let that simmer for 30 minutes. Be careful not to let it stick to the bottom. Once it starts burning, that taste goes through the whole sauce. So if you're using a flame, you might want to put a diffuser underneath it, or just watch it and stir it on a regular basis so that it does not stick to the bottom. For making the filling, you're going to use the 1 cup of half and half. You're going to mix that with the eggs, the ricotta cheese, and the Parmesan Romano mix. The mozzarella cheese you're going to save for the top. And then you're going to start layering. So this is a standard lasagna pan, size pan, which is about 10 by 14 or so. And you're going to start by putting a thin coating of the sauce on the bottom to keep it from sticking. Then you're going to lay down the noodles. Now, I do not cook my noodles first, and I do not buy the box of noodles that say no boil noodles. That's just a scam. You don't have to boil any noodles. And they actually cook in the sauce and become very al dente, and it's a wonderful way of making lasagna. And I'm telling you, when you're making it for 100 people especially, it saves so much time to not have to cook the lasagna noodles first. So you put down the sauce, then you take the noodles right out of the box, and you do a layer of the noodles. Then you put half of the filling on top, and you put that, spread that out evenly. Then you do half of the box of arugula, and you need 2 cups of the mozzarella for the top. So if you have extra mozzarella, you can sprinkle some mozzarella in the layers as well. And then you're going to repeat: sauce, filling, arugula, a little bit of mozzarella, and then noodles again. And you're going to finish the top with noodles, cover it with tomato sauce, and then you're going to bake it in the oven for 45 minutes, and you're going to cover it. And you're going to remove that from the oven, and then you're going to sprinkle the rest of the mozzarella cheese on top, and then bake it for another 15 minutes uncovered, just so that the mozzarella cheese melts and starts getting a little golden on the edges. Sprinkle it with some chopped parsley, and you know it's finished when you can insert a fork or a knife right through the noodles and they're soft. And that is it. You know, so it bakes for about an hour. It's delicious. Let it sit for about 10 minutes before you actually cut into it if you're going to serve it right away. Or you can serve it ahead of time. I mean, you can bake it ahead of time and keep it in the refrigerator and reheat it, or you can freeze it and reheat it. Either way. So that's it. Let me know how you like it. I love feedback. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest, Eric Weltman. He is the senior organizer from Food and Water Watch in New York. He has over 20 years experience working in these social justice campaigns and building progressive power around his work. He's helped to organize lots of different coalitions that are doing great work, and I'm going to let him tell us more about the work of Food and Water Watch. All right, Eric, are you with me?
I certainly am. And Bhavani, first of all, I want to thank you and acknowledge all your tremendous work. Bhavani, you're certainly one of our crucial allies on Long Island and New York and beyond, and I always love, frankly, hearing about all the amazing work that you're doing, because it really is very noble, very inspiring, very motivating, and it is a crucial part of, you know, all the work, you know, everything that we're trying to accomplish. You're a really crucial piece of that puzzle, so to speak. So I want to
thank you,
not only for, you know, having us on the show, having Food and Water Watch on the show, but for everything that you do.
Thanks so much. So why don't you tell people, just in case there's anyone out there that still does not know what Food and Water Watch does, your organization is amazing, and you are also one of my allies. Whenever I'm looking for events, I always go to your website to find out what is going on. So
thank you.
Well,
Food and Water Watch has been cited as the most powerful organization you've never heard of.
Really?
Our influence in some ways extends far beyond our name recognition. But and perhaps for good reason, Food and Water Watch is just celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. So we are, you know, an organization, a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., but we have offices in Europe and in Latin America and across the country, including in Brooklyn, New York, where I work out of. And our mission is to ensure that the food and the water that we consume is safe, accessible, sustainably produced, and to fend off, corporate influence and abuse over these vital resources. And so over the last 10 years, we've had a number of accomplishments, including banning fracking here in New York. That was a very significant accomplishment, and we're now working to extend that ban to public lands, to federal lands, as well as to other states and regions here in New York and here in the United States and across the world. We're fighting to label GMOs, and we now have the opportunity to do so, since, thankfully, you know, the DARC Act did not make its way into the federal budget agreement. Unfortunately, Bhavani, as you noted, country of origin labeling was eliminated, largely in response to a WTO lawsuit. So the World Trade Organization deemed that our cool country of origin labeling was hampering a trade, so Congress repealed country of origin labeling, and they also, unfortunately, repealed the ban on the export of petroleum out of the budget negotiations. But we do still have the opportunity to label our GMOs, and so that's something Food and Water Watch is going to be working.
Sorry, can you say that again? They repealed the export of petroleum?
Yeah, so there was a ban on the export of oil in the United States that was instituted in the 70s. And unfortunately, you know, the oil and gas industry, in their efforts to expand their markets for fracked oil overseas, won a repeal of that ban.
So they repealed the ban.
It's bad. So there's basically a couple of bad. You know, unfortunately, what happens with these budget negotiations is they try to cram in all these, you know, things, these policies that are really unrelated to the actual budget. So there was some serious concern that the DARC Act, Monsanto's dream bill, would be somehow incorporated into the budget, and we managed to fend that off. So we still do have the opportunity to label GMOs at the state level, and that, again, that's something that Food and Water Watch is going to be focusing on tremendously, you know, here in New York in 2016. But cool country of origin labeling was repealed, as you noted, as well as the ban on petroleum exports.
The World Trade Organization, these lawsuits is what is so scary about the the trade treaty.
That is the other thing that, you know, as we're working to ban fracking, as we're working to label GMOs, Food and Water Watch is also involved in efforts to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. So that's going to be a crucial part of our work in 2016 because, you know, to be honest, you know, Food and Water Watch, we don't necessarily, you know, care about trade per se, but we are very concerned, you know, as was noted, how these trade agreements really empower corporations to not only, you know, ship jobs overseas and you know, harm our economy and hurt employment, but also, you know, weaken our crucial environmental laws and health rules and regulations. So that's, and just in summary, a lot of what Food and Water Watch does is, you know, building up grassroots power, people power. I mean, we're never going to have as much money as the Monsantos and the Walmarts and the ExxonMobils of the world, but in taking them on and winning, you know, what we have and what we're trying to build is more people power.
Right.
And so we encourage folks to, you know, check out our website, foodandwaterwatch.org, and sign up for the email list, and sign up for Bhavani's email list, too, if you're not on that already.
Well, you know, the first time I met you, Eric, was at the NOFA Winter Conference.
I remember that vividly.
So do I.
I remember that vividly.
I don't know if it was 10 years ago or 8 years ago.
I was so impressed with you at that conference.
I remember. I was like, I can't believe I didn't know of your organization. And then I found out you were relatively new, so I didn't feel so bad. But
that was the first time I was at that conference. And, you know, we go there, you know, just about every year. Patty Lavera, who's our food program director in D.C., she actually spends a lot of the year going around to the various, you know, conferences. And, it is a great conference.
And you were one of the main organizers in the People's Climate March that took place last year.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was, you know, in some ways a signature event in our climate movement. And, you know, when you're talking about what happened in Paris, you know, this month, I think that's one of the big, you know, decisive factors. And what's so different this time around is, I think basically, well, there's two things. One, you know, the evidence and the urgency is only, you know, increasing. You know, the rising tide of climate catastrophes around the world with thousands of lives lost and mass displacement. And, you know, there's a lot of concerns about, you know, refugees. And we know that that's one of the factors that's driving people from their homes is these climate catastrophes and their inability to access, you know, clean water or to grow food. So if you're worried about, you know, people being displaced, that's got to be, you know, one of the driving concerns is climate change. So I think the evidence and the urgency is only increasing. But it's also, Bhavani, like you said, you know, with the climate march, and other things, the power of the global movement for justice, climate justice, is only growing. Just over a year ago, we had 400,000 people at the People's Climate March in Manhattan, an absolutely stupendous show of force. You know, we won the ban on fracking in New York, obviously, as I mentioned. There's been a really tremendous increase in the move for public and private divestment, to divest from fossil fuels, and organizations like, you know, 350.org and others are really driving that. So you see, you know, colleges and universities and churches and even the Rockefeller Family Fund, which, you know, folks are probably aware. I mean, the Rockefellers, you know, made their money in oil, and here you have, you know, the Rockefeller, one of their foundations, you know, divesting from fossil fuels, which, you know, is sort of a remarkable
amazing
thing.
Right. Right.
And then there's, you know, of course, the Pope's encyclical.
Right. Well, I wanted to talk about that because, you know, the climate talks that took place in 2009 back in Copenhagen were really disappointing. Basically, nothing really came out of it. There was all this talks, and they kept meeting these roadblocks, and no one could get past them. And the vibe around this the Paris climate talks was very different. I mean, I know there were negotiations that took place beforehand, and then the Pope came out with that huge, you know, paper that he wrote that really talked about how spiritual organizations, the church included, has to embrace this as a real issue to discuss and to move on. Mm-hmm. Do you think that took really got to people's heart and influenced the Paris?
Absolutely. I mean, let's Bill McKibben might say, let's do the math. Bill McKibben, the inspiration and founder of 350.org,
uh-huh.
and one of the seminal organizations in the climate change movement. You know, he likes that. Let's use the math. Do the math. You've got a combination of sound science, increasing scientific evidence about the links between, you know, emissions and climate change. You've got the real world evidence of, you know, climate catastrophe, which, you know, also was a factor in the ban on fracking in New York, right? The fact that we could, you know, visit Pennsylvania and see the evidence of fracking's impacts. Well, likewise, I mean, we're seeing growing evidence of climate change catastrophe around the world. You've got the growing grassroots movement, you know, again, as evidenced by the People's Climate March and all the tremendous organizing that's being done, you know, here in New York, United States, across the world. And you add to it the moral authority of the Pope, as well as the clout and influence of all the other, you know, faith leaders and institutions. And I saw that, you know, again in the People's Climate March. It wasn't just, you know, the Catholic Church. I mean, there were so many, you know, faith institutions, so many faith leaders, the Jewish community, the Muslim community. These were people that, you know, that lent their physical assets. I mean, the churches. I mean, you know, as a veteran organizer, I can tell you, you know, most of my meetings are held in churches and church basements, and just, you know, the churches themselves as institutions are very, very important assets to our advocacy and our organizing. So I would say 100% that, you know, the Pope's, you know, moral clout and influence, you know, is a decisive factor, as is, you know, all the faith leaders and institutions, from the Hindus to the Muslims to the Jews to the, you know, Protestants. It's really been a decisive factor, I know, in the organizing that I've been doing here in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, the goal of the Paris Climate Conference was, what would you say was the main goal of the Paris Climate Conference?
Well, I would say there was two or three things. One is, and I should just, you know, quickly note that unfortunately I wasn't there. It would have been fun, but, you know, Food and Water Watch had a good representation there, including our executive director, Winona Hatter, a number of other staff, and of course we linked up with so many other, you know, organizations and allies across the world. And I'll just, you know, note that was in and of itself, you know, one of our goals in being there, was making those, you know, stronger connections. But in terms of, you know, concrete outcomes, you know, we really wanted to see a limit on global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. We wanted, you know, to begin a rapid transition to renewable energy. We wanted to ban fracking and keep fossil fuels in the ground. Keep it in the ground. That's one of the you know, phrases that we're using is keep it in the ground. No one ever anticipated that we would achieve what we needed to in Paris, which is why, you know, I really want to talk a little bit about, you know, next steps and how we can, you know, use what happened in Paris as a, sort of a springboard to other steps, you know, here in New York and across the country and the world. But, you know, there were some, real results. The deal in Paris includes an agreement to limit global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius with an aim of 1.5 degrees and achieve climate neutrality that would require phasing out fossil fuels soon after mid-century. And one thing that, you know, our allies at 350 note that, and again, they would, you know, I think, share the sentiment that this agreement isn't the be-all and end-all, but that 2-degree pledge would require keeping 80% the world's remaining fossil fuels in the ground, and a 1.5 degree target even more, and that countries are required to come back to the table every 5 years to increase their ambitions in reaching those goals.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but again, I think that, you know, Food and Water Watch and our allies achieved a great deal more in having a presence in Paris. You know, as I noted, you know, Food and Water Watch and our allies, we came together as a movement, and you know, notwithstanding the severe limits on you know, mass gatherings, we did have a number of demonstrations, we had a number of meetings, we had a number of conferences that enabled us to, you know, really come together more of as a global movement. So I think that was a serious outcome, concrete outcome from our presence in Paris. And we also had, and this, you know, in some ways gets to, you know, the question of how we use what happened as Paris as a springboard. We used it as an opportunity to directly pressure decision makers like Governor Brown of California. I mean, I think everybody, you know, knows that Governor Cuomo took the courageous step last year of banning fracking in New York, as well as recently vetoing an LNG facility, a liquefied natural gas facility off the coast of Long Island. We need Governor Brown, who I think, with some justification, you know, considers himself an environmentalist dating back to, you know, the early 70s, as well as a climate leader. We need him to understand that climate leaders don't frack.
Right.
We need Governor Brown to understand that climate leaders don't frack, and he was in Paris, and we were there too. And again, you know, recognizing the constraints, we were able to deliver that message to Governor Cuomo. Governor Brown. At a number of venues.
He's still trying to promote himself as an environmentalist, and yet he allows fracking in California. And the thing that blows me away is that here is a state that is dealing with years of drought. They do not have enough fresh water. They don't have enough water for the farmers to water the fields. And
mm-hmm.
yet, it's okay for them to spend millions of gallons of fresh water per frack. For every frack that they do, they waste millions of gallons of fresh water that then comes up contaminated, and then they have to dispose of. I mean, it's just the most stupid thing. It makes me crazy. I just don't understand.
It really is hard to reconcile. And to be honest, I say this as someone who's actually met Governor Brown.
Baffling.
It's hard to reconcile.
Right, right. At this moment, let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of those next steps that we just touched on. Okay, everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Eric Weltman from Food and Water Watch, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
The story behind the story, your story, my story, is all in the mix on Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. This is Utrice Lead inviting you to share your thoughts and opinions and expand your knowledge about critical issues of the day, Monday through Friday, right after Gary Null's show. Listen live to a broadcast or get Lead Stories whenever you want from PRN's archive. You can even rate the show on iTunes. Now pass the word. Tell this story to everyone you know. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Mike Fader. I want to tell you about my show, The Turning Point, broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. It's not just politics or pop culture or art or personal essays or storytelling. It's all of those. And it's in a spontaneous blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
Carrie Harrison with you, inviting you to join me on The Smart Show every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're not able to catch me live, you can go to the archives at prn.fm or harrison.fm. Don't forget, it's impeccable behavior to rate the show on iTunes. We come to you each Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live from Hollywood, where we bring on the movers and shakers, whistleblowers and muckrakers. There's nothing like it anywhere else, and it's here on PRN.FM. If you like a smart show, then join me, Carrie Harrison. It's Harrison on the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back on this very warm Christmas Eve day. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Eric Weltman from Food and Water Watch. Eric, are you with me?
I still am.
Great.
I'm there when you need me, Bhavani.
Great. So going back to the climate talks that were going on in Paris, The deal that they came up with, of course, is not a binding legal agreement. They still have to work that out starting, I think, in April for the next year. Here in, I don't know if it's New York or Washington, they're going to be, you know, making it into a law that will be somewhat binding. I have no idea who's going to be holding the different nations accountable. Mm-hmm. That will be something I guess we'll all find out about.
That'll be up to us.
What's that?
That'll be up to us.
Right. You're right. We're going to be the Water Watch people, Food and Water Watch. But, I wanted to know what do you see coming out of these climate talks? What do you see as our next steps as the people on the ground who need to band together, to work together, to make our country step up to the plate? What do you see?
I think there's a fairly clear path that I think all the organizations and movements and constituencies and communities are united behind. One is, you know, keep it in the ground, keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and two is have a just transition to renewable energy. You know, one that, you know, embraces needs of workers and communities and environment. So it's keep fossil fuels in the ground and have a rapid and just transition to renewable energy. And I can, you know, talk a little bit more about, you know, what some of this, you know, entails. But again, I think it is a fairly simple path. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground and we need to transition right away, make an immediate transition to renewable energy. In terms of, you know, Food and Water Watch's agenda and those of many of our allies, you know, here in New York and across the country, you know, obviously we did achieve a ban on fracking in New York. You know, Food and Water Watch is trying to extend that ban to other states. We're working in Pennsylvania, we're working in Florida, we're working in Maryland, we're working in Colorado and California and numerous other states, you know, to ban fracking. We're working to ban fracking on public lands, which you noted at the beginning of the program. Food and Water Watch is working with a representative from Wisconsin, Mark Pocan, on a bill to ban fracking on public lands, federal lands. We need to stop all fossil fuel infrastructure. You know, here in New York and across the country, you know, notwithstanding our fracking ban, we're still facing an onslaught of fossil fuel-related infrastructure, including bomb trains, including compressor stations, including pipelines, including, you know, power plants, some of which you know, the government's trying to, you know, repower from coal to natural gas. We think that's a tremendous mistake. Here in New York, we're fighting the AIM pipeline going through Westchester. There's the Constitution pipeline. There's the Pilgrim pipelines. So Food and Water Watch and allies here in New York, across the country, are working to oppose any and all, you know, new fossil fuel infrastructure. You know, as we noted, we had a tremendous victory with Governor Cuomo vetoing the Port Ambrose liquefied natural gas facility.
So what's happening? Do we have any movement on the wind farm that was proposed off of the coast of Long Island?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I will just quickly note that your Food and Water Watch is calling for 100% renewable energy in the United States by 2035. That's 20 years, but we think it's technologically feasible. I would suggest your listeners, if you're interested, to Google the Solutions Project. The Solutions Project, that's an organization that was instigated by the actor Mark Ruffalo, who folks may know is a tremendous ally in our efforts. Josh Fox, who, of course, is the producer of the Gasland films, as well as some academics. There's Mark Jacobson from Stanford. So please Google the Solutions Project. And one of the things that you'll see is some clear evidence that, again, it is technologically feasible to transition to 100% renewable energy here in New York. And a crucial part of that is, as you noted, offshore wind off of Long Island. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Jacobson plan is for New York to get roughly 40% of its energy from offshore wind, much, if not most of which, would be from, you know, off of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the demands that we need to make of Mayor de Blasio here in New York, is Governor Cuomo, is that they help, help support and spark the production of this wind power by ensuring a demand for it. So that's one of the things that, you know, Food and Water Watch and our allies are going to be really pushing for, is for Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio to guarantee a certain amount of demand for that power through purchasing agreements.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that could help ensure that investment is made in offshore wind, is by guaranteeing a demand for it.
Uh-huh.
So that's absolutely, I mean, you know, we occasionally hear it said that, you know, the Long Island is the Saudi Arabia of wind. There's tremendous amount of potential for wind power off of Long Island, and that's something that we definitely want to be pushing for.
Yeah, well, I was in Puerto Rico a couple of weeks ago, and it's amazing the wind turbines that they have there. They're amazing, beautiful looking, and I don't know what percentage of their energy they're getting from the wind, but I'm sure it's a lot because there were a lot of them.
Sweet, yeah. The Great Plains of the United States are also great potential source of wind power. I would just say that there's a lot of organizations working on this, from the Working Families Party to the Sierra Club to the Sane Energy Project. I mean, I'm really, to be honest, tremendously excited at how a lot of this is coming together in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, you know, notwithstanding the fracking ban in New York, we still need to focus a lot on, you know, stopping fossil fuel infrastructure, stopping the pipeline, stopping the compressor stations, stopping the Seneca Lake storage facilities, stopping these, you know, coal plants from being, you know, repurposed into gas-fired plants. But I still think that there's, you know, room for a lot more great work to be done on making this transition to renewable energy. The other thing I just wanted to note is part of that is that Food and Water Watch is organizing a major march for a clean energy revolution on July 24th in Philadelphia. It's the day before the Democratic National Convention, and we're hoping to have thousands and thousands of people there. We're going to be organizing buses from New York City, Long Island, and throughout the region. So I urge folks to check that out on Facebook. And on the internet, it's a march for a clean energy revolution on July 24th in Philadelphia. And, you know, as I said earlier, we're going to have, you know, a lot of the, you know, demands that are emerging, you know, from this, you know, movement for climate justice. You know, keep it in the ground, ban fracking, and make a rapid and just transition to renewable energy.
Now, I have a question for you.
Please.
You know, I think it's, I don't know how common knowledge it is, but for those of us working on greenhouse gas emissions or educating ourselves about it, we know that the global industrial production of meat is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than all of the cars, planes, trains, and ships combined.
Mm-hmm.
Yet little is being done to curb that, to educate consumers of that. I mean, most consumers still think that transportation is the largest problem. Why do you think that's not being taken up by all the groups? I mean, I don't know if Food and Water Watch addresses meat consumption at all as one of the worst polluters.
That's a good question, and you know, there are a number of answers, none of which I'm sure will be, you know, entirely satisfactory. One thing I'll just note is Food and Water Watch is doing a lot of work around factory farms, a lot of work. We're trying to ban the misuse of antibiotics in factory farms. We're, you know, going up against, you know, Monsanto and, you know, large agribusiness to try to, you know, label GMOs. You know, whenever the farm bill comes up every 4 or 5 years, you know, we're doing a lot of work to try to institute reforms to, you know, curb the powers of the, you know, big agribusiness and you know, promote sustainable food production. And by way of sustainable, I mean not just environmentally, but ensuring that, you know, farmers actually have a sustainable livelihood.
Right, right, of course.
I think that's a crucial piece of the puzzle. That said, to be honest, while we're very concerned with, I should say, methane emissions from fracked gas, we haven't so much, you know, addressed that aspect of the pollution from factory farms. Though, you know, we are doing a lot of work, like a lot of other organizations, around, you know, other environmental impacts from, you know, CAFOs and so forth. In terms of why the other big green groups aren't addressing, you know, meat consumption, I don't know.
You know, it just seems like an obvious, you know, like the elephant in the room. It's like it's right here, and nobody wants to really talk about it. And, you know, my guess would be because people don't want to ruffle anyone's feathers. Nobody really wants to make the sacrifices that have to be made to really curb this. I mean, we have to do it in the way we use water in our homes. We have to do it in, you know, the way that we shop. We have to do it in many, many different areas. And this is another area. I mean, people have to realize that they cannot have meat three times a day, every day, and think we're going to be able to get this under control. People have to give up some. And I guess that's one of the things I love doing in my work, is showing people how wonderfully satisfying and filling and substantial a vegetarian meal can be. Because so often people think a vegetarian meal just consists of, you know, a salad or some grilled vegetables,
right,
and they're not going to feel satisfied with that. And that's why I challenge people to send me their recipes of their chicken marsala or their, you know, pot roast or, you know, their meaty dishes that they can't imagine giving up. You know, for me, when I became a vegetarian, although I'm really a pescatarian because I do eat some fish, when I gave up meat, it was like I couldn't imagine giving up my dad's barbecued spare ribs. And I'm sure many of my listeners have heard this story, but that, you know, my dad was from the Midwest, and we every summer we'd have a couple barbecues in our house that, you know, the whole neighborhoods would be involved and all the cousins, and it was a huge thing. And so I couldn't imagine that. And so it was like, all right, how am I going to satisfy that craving? And I came up with barbecue tempeh that totally, you know, it's all about the sauce.
That's
and that's it. So many of the things. And things like tofu has no flavor of thorns, so it takes on any flavor you get.
Yeah, I've just started eating a lot of tempeh lately. Well, Bhavani, I'm 48 years old, and I haven't had a bite of meat in 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, I think the very second day that I was a vegetarian, when I was maybe 12 years old, I asked my mom to make some corned beef hash, not realizing for some reason that corned beef hash had meat in it. But so I was sorely disappointed that I wasn't going to have any corned beef hash anymore.
Right.
Sort of odd.
Right. But you can make something like that using seitan would probably be the best for making corned beef hash.
Oh, okay.
So,
well,
you know, there's different...
I haven't missed it. It's been a few decades I've managed. But
right.
Two things to just sort of address your question, which I think is a very good one. One is that it's obviously, you know, easier to in some ways, to target and dare I say, you know, demonize the Exxon Mobils of the world. And second, in terms of, you know, policy, not that energy policy is easy. It's unfortunately far from it. It's hard to come up with policies sometimes that promote the good things that we want to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, healthy food in schools or clean energy. And I think that is one of the challenges we face in 2016. I mean, again, from, you know, in some ways from an organizing standpoint, it's always easier to stop something that's bad than, you know, promote and institute something that's good. But, you know, it's got to be done.
Yeah, it does have to be done. And I think it would be really helpful for more of the on-the-ground environmental organizations to really start talking about that, not in a dogmatic preacher type of way, because, as we know, you get a lot further with honey than you do with vinegar, you know, but to really appeal to people's moral understanding of right and wrong. You know, this is about something that everyone can do immediately. I mean, if everybody who we ate meat 7 times a week, or more than that, probably, most people who are meat eaters eat it more than just once a day, if you really cut your meat consumption in half, think of what that would do. You know, that's not cutting it out. That's not saying become a vegetarian. It's saying cut it in half. Use meat more as a flavoring and a seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Use it more occasional for a special occasion. But, you know, we just need to do that. And then when people do buy meat, not buy cheap meat that's being raised in that horrible industrial agricultural way, but then when they do buy meat, to support the local farmer trying to do it in the right way, trying to give the animal at least a decent life while they're alive, you know?
Well, small actions multiplied by, you know, millions of people can obviously have a huge impact, whether you're talking about, you know, reducing meat consumption or voting or, you know, calling an elected official.
Right,
I mean, it's always the case that your one action, you know, your one vote isn't going to win the election, right? Or your
it's teamwork.
Reduction in meat consumption, that's not going to save the planet, but you multiply it by your friends and family and people you talk to and, you know, your colleagues, neighbors.
Right. What's Margaret Mead's quote, you know, one action, you know, won't change the world, but it's the only thing that ever did. I forget what the exact quote is, but,
That's the right principle. And by the way, keep in mind, like, you know, again, with the, you know, the ban on fracking, we didn't have millions and millions of dollars for ads. The way we did it was by, you know, someone once asked Cesar Chavez from the United Farm Workers, what's the secret to organizing? And they were expecting some, you know, great wisdom. And was first you talk to one person, then you talk to another, and then you talk to another.
Right.
That's how we won the ban on fracking, is just by people talking to each other.
Anyway, Eric, we are out of time. Can you just quickly share with everyone Food and Water Watch's website so they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, foodandwaterwatch.org. I'm, you know, from an office in Brooklyn, so you're welcome to, you know, stop by or send an email or, you know, help out. But, yeah, check out the website, foodandwaterwatch.org. And thank you, Bhavani. You are a gem.
Thank you, Eric. And everyone, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, whatever it is you celebrate. Just go out and celebrate with it all. And have a great, great time, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.